Okay, we are still in the chapter of the book called The Field of Battle, the field of Kurukshetra. It's chapter 25 of the book. No, that's the path of Bhakti Yoga. It's chapter 26 of the book, The Field of Battle. We are in chapter 13 of the Gita, from verse 19 to the end of chapter 13. And I will now read the Gita verses without reading all the numbers. Know that both Purusha and Prakriti are without a beginning. Know also that all the modifications and qualities, the gunas of nature, are born of Prakriti. Prakriti, I think it's called, but I'm not sure. Material cause and effect are the product of Prakriti. Joy and sorrow, the mental experience of those effects, are the product of Purusha, the soul in man. Purusha acting through Prakriti and the soul acting through the body both experience impersonally the gunas born of nature. It is attachment to the gunas which causes men to return to earth in good or evil wombs. The Supreme Spirit, manifested in each body as the soul, is the detached witness. It is through man's conscience, the counselor, who, though accepting all, offers guidance if asked. The soul is the sustainer, the one who experiences without reacting with feelings of either pleasure or pain, the great Lord and Supreme Self. Whatever his mode of life, one who, by realization, understands the relationship between the spirit, also his individual soul, and nature, and, on an individual level, the body, with its threefold gunas, even though he engages outwardly in the activity of this life, need never again undergo rebirth. To behold the self in the self, the purified ego, by the self, the clarified mind, some seekers follow the path of meditation, some that of knowledge, and some the path of selfless activity, service. Some men, ignorant of these three paths, heed the instructions of their guru, accepting what he teaches as their supreme refuge. They approach the truth worshipfully and thus cross over the river of death. O best of the Bharatas, Arjuna, whatever is in existence, know it to have been born of the union of Kshetra, nature and the body, and Kshetragya, spirit and the soul. He sees truly who perceives the Supreme Lord, present equally in all beings, the imperishable within the perishing. Behold the divine presence everywhere. He no longer harms himself by self-ignorance. Thus he attains the supreme goal. That man sees truly, who perceives that all actions are performed by nature, Prakriti, alone, not by the self, which is above all action. When the yogi sees all beings as contained in the one, having expanded his consciousness and sympathy to include all living beings, he merges into Brahman. Arjuna, the Supreme Self, having no beginning and no attributes, even though it dwells in a body as a realized master, neither acts nor is touched by any action. As the subtle, all-pervading ether is unaffected by what moves through it, similarly the self, though pervading the whole body, is never affected by it. O Bharata, Arjuna, as the sun illuminates the whole world, so does the Lord of the field, God and his reflection as the soul, illuminate the whole body of nature and of man. They go to the Supreme, who perceive with the eye of wisdom the distinction between the Kshetra and Kshetragya, and understand how beings can become liberated from involvement in Prakriti. Thus ends the 13th chapter called The Field of Battle of the Upanishad of the Holy Bhagavad Gita. in the dialogue between Sri Krishna and Arjuna, discussing yoga and the science of God realization. Okay. Does anyone have any questions or thoughts left over from last week or anything from the reading this week where we should start? You rarely do. Okay. Yes, Rick. Yeah? Okay, I spent a lot of time looking at the glossary here, and I'm going to look at the glossary again because I cannot keep these words strongly in my mind. He describes Purusha as the transcendent God, the Father. I think the way to understand that is the soul is that part of that transcendent form that we personally experience, that appears to be individualized. These are all these different words and definitions which become so difficult to follow, because on one hand it all merges into one, and on the other hand we experience it in a certain way. So as I just take it in my sort of little capacity to understand, what they're really trying to make us understand is that we are just a little fragment of this greater reality. And we use the word soul, which is not a Sanskrit word, it's an English word. And that's because it has the connotation, it doesn't have an exact meaning, he's trying to give it one. The connotation is that it's that little spark of divinity that makes us who we are. And without, it's the soul that makes us alive, it's not the ego that makes us alive. And that we have this choice when we're experiencing our own reality, that we can either experience it in the aspect of ourselves which moves with the duality and is always in the changing universe, or we can experience ourselves as that calm, impersonal, unchanging witness which sees all of that happening but is never caught up in it. And I think the soul is the part that sees it all happening but is never caught up in it. And yet, at the same time, it is also the animating force. It's the ocean moving the waves. And when we live outside of the soul, we live in the waves. And so we feel ourselves bound by all these contrary and dual forces. When we live in the soul, that storm rages around us, but we never actually find ourselves moved by it. Would that be fair? So Purusha is that whole force. Soul is the little piece of it that lives in us. And that's probably maybe accurate or maybe not, but I think it works. I have a really hard time keeping Sanskrit in my mind because I have no, except words like karma, that I've lived with long enough. Yeah.
Purusha is the person.
Well, he says it as Purusha is the transcendent God, the Father, the masculine principle beyond creation. What that means in this context is Prakriti is God in creation, the Mother. Purusha is God outside of creation, the Father. So when you're wanting to talk about the impersonal spirit beyond it all, you say Purusha. When you want to talk about Mother in creation, the way he describes it, it's wonderful here. Prakriti is the storm that whips up the waves, right? The movement of energy, the vibration, the om. They don't describe Prakriti as the om, but in other places you would say that. I'm always a little hesitant to make definitive statements because I just don't have these things clearly enough in my mind. Para Prakriti, you know, which is the immanent as opposed to overt nature, the hidden reality behind the whole material universe. And then you have apara prakriti, which is essentially, apara prakriti, where do I find it now? The outwardly manifesting creative force, Satan, Maya. See, para prakriti is the presence of the divine within nature. And apara, which means the opposite, is that force which keeps it moving away from God. That's about as good as I can do. I can explain the concepts, but not the words. Anything else? Shivani once cornered me thinking that I would know these things, and
asked me a question I couldn't even, didn't even know what the question was, what to speak of the answer. Because she's an old scholar, she had all the words right. No way, honey, not me. Okay, anything else? All right. What, the essential message of this chapter is a lot contained in the commentary to verse 13, chapter 13, verse 19, which is where he says, just Purusha and Prakriti are without a beginning, they're all modifications of nature and are born of Prakriti. And then he goes into this long discussion of Satan and the nature of God, whether God is personal or not personal. And it's a very subtle thing to understand. I'm going to start by just going from, I had a conversation this afternoon with a person, and they raised a question which I realized was exactly addressed in this little section. The issue was the common idea that when things happen, if you're a disciple, that they're happening because Master wants them to happen. This is how disciples often say, oh, I found a job, I found an apartment, I came, there was a place right for me to live, I got just this job, and you know, then I got the car that I wanted, and there was a place in the school for my kids, and it must be what Master wants. And then, of course, something else happens, and the job falls through, and the car breaks down, and the school turns out to be a bummer, and or one doesn't really like the experience and needs to have something else happen, and then you get all caught up in this, but I thought this was what Master wanted. And Swamiji in here writes about, how does he say it? He says, no longer can people view themselves so confidently as being watched over by an ever-benevolent, fatherly God who concerns himself intimately with human affairs, a loving personage who wants everyone to succeed in his life ambitions and to be humanly happy, one who really hopes that Joe will make up with Mary and that Bob will get the diploma his parents are so ardently praying he will get. And then he puts it in another place here. Swami has a lot of fun with this chapter. The view of things people held in the past made life into a sort of football game, with satanic and angelic forces vying together, often evenly matched, alas, each side fiercely battling for eventual victory. God is said to be all-powerful, all-knowing, all-caring, well, all-everything, except there's always that insidious serpent, Satan, who manages somehow to interfere with every good plan and to keep everyone wondering whether God really has in him the stuff that it takes to win. So he's sort of trying to balance out. But then he goes on to say that oddly enough, even though, and then he's talking about the effect of science on these traditional beliefs, and this is something Swamiji talks about a lot, about there used to be this very comfortable worldview. You know, when it was it Galileo who first asserted that the earth wasn't the center of the whole of all of creation, and he was excommunicated by the Catholic Church for declaring that? In other words, that man is not the center of the cosmos, that everything isn't directed toward us, that God's primary and only purpose is us. He was removed from the church for saying that, and only, I think, recently forgiven, if I have my facts correct, which I often don't. But I think that's what more or less happened. And there's this very tidy picture of creation in which we play a major role and God is our buddy. And if we're on his side, then we get helped. And if we don't, we don't. And then you have all this, you know, in the last 100 years or more, all this ever-expanding scientific understanding of the magnitude of the universe, how very small our little planet is, that there's billions of galaxies, that we're just this one little tiny thing over here, and yet we still, in some of our theology, are positing this infinite God whose primary concern is whether Joe makes up with Mary and whether Bob gets his degree. And so a lot of people are feeling that, you know, there just can't be any, it's just too ridiculous a concept. The forces don't match. Somebody wrote a whole book on this subject called Out of the Labyrinth, And the book is subtitled for those who want to believe but can't. And what he essentially does in a really brilliantly beautiful way, he just takes on all these scientific challenges to the idea that there is a divine force. And then he shows how science, far from undermining that, what it actually does is it explodes these little dogmas, but it doesn't necessarily lead to a universe in which there's no overarching consciousness. It's just that consciousness has to be seen in a completely much more expanded, much more impersonal reality than this little guy who helps me get what I want. And the balancing point here, which is so really, really difficult, I think, for devotees to understand, the only thing I can think about it is how personally God is concerned for us, but what he is concerned about. See, what we tend to think about is that every little tiny nuance of the dual universe in which we live, that God is egoically committed to my comfort and my pleasure as much as I am. And we sort of set these ideals up. Well, you know, I really want to be married. I really want to have children. This is a good thing. You know, why not? I deserve to have a nice home. Why shouldn't God want me to have a nice home? So I manifest a nice home, and then we go a step further. We not only think that God doesn't disapprove, we say that God made it for me. Master made it for me. This is what I wanted. I wanted this, and then God made it for me. And it isn't that he doesn't want it. And it isn't that it's wrong to involve him in everything we do, but the fine line we have to walk is the difference between true dedication to God and mere sentimentality. And Swami uses that word in here. And that's why this whole thing is called a battle, as he puts it this way, and this are his, again, Swami's not mincing words. Sweet, foolish sentiments don't win him. And he said, earnest, complete self-offering does. True miracles are a constant feature of the spiritual life. By appealing to the mother of the universe, people do receive her loving response. The condition for forming this responsibility with her is utter childlike trust and a total absence of selfish desire. Okay? Now, that gets really complicated. And the degree of focus on the upward moving aspiration of the spirit as opposed to the comfortable aspirations of the ego are what the real battle of Kurukshetra is about. And in this Mahabharata, which the Gita is just a little part of it, there's this whole story with Krishna and Arjuna having this conversation. And then the Gita ends because Arjuna has the courage to pick up his bow. So then what happens is the rest of the Mahabharata. And the rest of the Mahabharata is a gruesome, bitter fight to the death in which Arjuna has to slay all of these souls, cousins and relatives and friends who are now standing on the opposite side. He has to ruthlessly, you know, just do battle with them to the absolute death. He has to see his own sons killed. He has to see the life of his brothers threatened. And in the very end, almost everyone is dead. And finally, Arjuna and his brothers take possession of the kingdom. You know, they finally win what they're supposed to win. But the magnitude of the carnage and the impersonal determination and faith in what Krishna guides them to do, you know, it's a thrilling story. I highly recommend reading or listening to it. We have a recording in there of my telling of the story with all of the philosophical implications of it, and it's a really easy way to absorb a lot of good spiritual teaching because it's just a very entertaining tale. But there's a lot in it, and the battle about it is it moves from sweet sentimentality to the real understanding that it must be about total self-offering. And so Swami's trying to paint this picture here that there is this real conscious force that's always trying to diminish our commitment. And I was talking also again with someone else this afternoon. I'll go back to Master wanting us to have this or not having that. I was talking with someone else this afternoon, and you know, we were just comparing this path to other very valid paths in the world. But there's a degree of ruthlessness about the way we have to deal with ourselves and our ego that is really not attractive to most people. And I don't mean to be, you know, too harsh, because the fact of the matter is, the reason we can face that is because it is a very joyful experience. And this is what Swami's also trying to talk about. When Arjuna is given the choice of whether or not he wants all of Krishna's soldiers, his whole vast army, to fight on his side, or whether he wants Krishna alone, just driving his chariot, taking no part in the battle, Arjuna says immediately, well, I'll take Krishna. Of course I want Krishna, because wherever Krishna is, there will be the victory, the true victory that I seek. And so then Krishna's in the chariot with Arjuna. Chariot represents the body. Krishna represents the intuitive, the intuition, our relationship with God. And Arjuna knows that as long as Krishna is guiding him, no matter what happens, it will turn out right. And it isn't by any means guaranteed that he will be victorious or that he will even survive the battle. But it doesn't make any difference to Arjuna, because there's only one reality that is actually the joy-producing reality, and that reality is to be in this intimate relationship with God, willing to do whatever it is that we feel is required. Now, that, of course, sounds exactly like, oh, well, Master wanted me to have this job, Master wanted me to have this house, Master wanted me to have this school. But the extreme care that has to be taken is this other force of Maya that comes in and tries to cloud our minds with what is much more sentimental than intuitive. And part of it is, this is such a hard issue for me, I never really exactly know how to talk about this. I didn't really grow up spiritually following my own intuition. I grew up being guided by people I trusted. And that didn't mean that I didn't have very strong opinions, because I've always had very strong opinions. But those strong opinions were always presented in relationship to the insights offered by people I trusted. I remember it used to be a joke between Swamiji. Hi, Asha, how are you? I don't know, sir. How am I? You know? And on more than one occasion, he would say something I didn't expect, like, I'm a little concerned about you, you know, which I would not have necessarily said. But I don't know. How am I? I have my own opinion of how I am, but really, what do I know? You know? And later on in this very section, he talks about attunement to the guru. And he just throws in, it's on this page, is it important to be physically with the guru? Not necessarily. Mental attunement is everything. My guru told me that even one physical contact may suffice to seal the bond. There must, however, so he told me, be at least one outward contact. That contact can occur through an advanced disciple. But then he says, those, however, who think to form it only by mental acceptance on their part do not get the same results. Now, I keep reading that. First he says, mental attunement is everything. Then he says, one physical contact is enough, but it can be through an advanced disciple. But those who think to form it only by mental acceptance do not get the same results. Now, what he's implying there is that the disciples of the master play an important role in the relationship between the guru and the master, if the master is no longer in a physical body. Now, we've been fortunate in our lives to have Swami Kriyananda with us, and we have both his example and his teachings. But what I feel Swamiji is saying there, and I'm putting myself out on a limb a little bit on this, is at the same time that we have to cultivate this deep inner sense of what master wants of us, we also have to be intensely vigilant lest mere sentiment masquerade as intuition and lead us down a primrose path. And so Swami, in this paragraph, inserts the need, the role of the disciples in helping other disciples who come after them to understand what the guru wants. And we have to, and then later on, though, he says, in other parts of this, he says, let's see, talking completely about how this isn't completely an individual process, that nobody gets to God. Final victory is reserved only for individuals. In the world of all victories are transitory. Liberation is achieved singly, not by group effort, he says. Individual seekers must dive one by one beneath the agitation of the storm at the surface and find peace at the depths. Groups can provide a supportive environment, but the exercise of conscience must be done personally and often solitarily. It is ever a matter between the individual and his maker. So here I am, because I'm reading Swami, talking about this side and that side and this side and that side. But what Swami is really saying through all of this is that attunement is a very subtle process, and we must be very careful not to presume. And we must both be willing to make the effort, but part of that willing effort is that childlike trust that allows us to listen attentively to advice when it's given to us. I've often said to people, if you think God can speak through you, why do you think he can't speak to you through someone else? Why would you be the only one who could receive intuition? You know, why must you feel like I have to decide this myself, when in fact, someone else could know better than you and just tell you, and you would recognize it as true? Were you going to ask a question, Patrick?
If someone asks me how I'm doing, I always say, I feel great. That must be what God wants. If you say, I don't know how I feel, that seems to open Maya to what actually happens.
That's a very good question, Patrick, because when people ask me how I'm doing, I always, almost always say I'm doing wonderfully well, because I am. Only when Swami looks at me with a certain kind of look in his eye and asks how I am, do I say, I don't know, sir, how am I doing? It's only when there's a certain kind of question from somebody that I trust, who I intuitively feel wants me to listen rather than to speak, that was when I would ask that question. Is that fair? The rest of the time, I'm with you. Why not just say we feel wonderful? See, that's why I'm trying to talk about a razor's edge here. There's a razor's edge where we have to definitely commit ourselves to the belief in our own understanding, but we have to commit ourselves with absolute humility, which allows us also to hear that maybe we're being a little too self-directed and not actually divinely directed. This I see in Swami Kriyananda. He's so humble about his point of view, and he's so interested in what other people think, especially where he himself is concerned. Even to this day, he'll ask everyone, what do you think about that? Do you think this is a good idea? And he listens. It's not just an act. He genuinely listens, because he knows that God can speak through anyone. I remember, this was years ago, but this woman who was basically, she was not normal in her perceptions of reality. I won't use slang words. I'll just say she had a unique point of view. And I was at that time in charge of Swami's appointments, and she absolutely insisted that she had to speak to Swami. She had a message for him. My instinct was to be protective of him and not subject him to the rantings of someone that I didn't think was really entirely connected. But I was obligated to tell him that she wanted to see him, because it wasn't my position to withhold information. So Swamiji at first sort of rolled his eyes, and then he said, no, I'll see her. And then he said to me afterwards, he said, whenever I feel that so-and-so has nothing to say to me, he says, that's always a sign that, you know, I should not be thinking like that. So it's more sort of as an act of discipline, he agreed to see her. And after he spoke to her later, he said to me, she had a real message for me. She had something that was really important for me to hear. And it was, one, don't ever dismiss anyone as being incapable of being a channel for God. And secondly, the actual facts of what she said were really valid.
It had something to do with the direction of Ananda. It was not, you know, it wasn't earth-changing, but it was important. And it was a very important lesson that Swami put across, which is, just because we can be inwardly guided, let us not become so infatuated with our own guidance that we neither ask nor listen. Nor should we become so subject to everybody else's opinion that we have no sounding board of our own that we can turn back to. And especially we have to be very careful when we start defining God in terms of all these little things he does for us. Because he's just as likely to pull the rug out from underneath us. Because what we have to realize, and this is the single point, is that God doesn't really care whether we're comfortable. He doesn't really care whether it works out nice for us. He wants, the only thing that God wants, and Swami defines it as our love, the power of the universe is moving to strip us of all factors within ourselves that keep us from perceiving ourselves as infinite. And there's a conspiracy that's going on in this universe in between these two forces. And one is the force of Maya, apara prakriti, which is consciously sort of trying to keep us involved in creation. And that's the part of our mind. And that doesn't work in the form of this guy coming with a tail and little horns, you know, and trying to get us to, you know, commit ourselves to the demon liquor necessarily. He comes in a much different way, which is, God, of course God wants you to be comfortable. Why wouldn't he want you to be comfortable? You know, why wouldn't he want you to have a happy relationship? Of course he would. And we say, yes, that's right. God loves me, so he gives me just what I want. And that's really this And now, it's not that God won't give you that. It's when we begin to define our relationship to God with how nice he is to us and how much he fulfills all the little desires we have. Oh, what a remarkable coincidence. God's will and mine coincide exactly. Isn't that just really something special? Well, maybe yes, maybe no. But then what happens when all of that gets blown to bits by some act of violence or act of nature or act of betrayal on the part of someone? You know, do we have the same easy, unwavering commitment to the fact that, well, God wanted me to have it, now he doesn't? You know, where is our commitment? Is our commitment to the comfort provided by thinking that God is really on my side? Or are we standing back and not really riding all those waves at all, but just watching them? Yes, of course, if God makes great success for you, then go with it. But the whole chapter here is about what part of us, where are we living? Are we living back in the deep ocean that just rides, you know, rides with the waves but is never identified and attached to them? Or do we start riding the good waves and then getting distressed when the troughs come inevitably? And the great battle, intense battle, the inner battle, is to always feel divinely uplifted and divinely connected, whether we're on the wave or in the trough. And to equally see that all of those things are coming to us from the divine. And yet, as Swami writes in here about Master and the shortbread, you know, that the Masters enjoy this world. Why not? The shortbread is sweet. It's pleasant to eat. This woman makes it for him all the time. Why not? You know, we don't have to hide away and think that we're somehow being more detached by being afraid of all these things. Now, of course, at the same time, we can't be presumptuous and just think, well, because God will rescue me, then I can just go and do anything, because if it's not right, God will tell me. Once a disciple said to Swamiji, well, if Master doesn't want me to do it, he'll tell me. Swami's response after the man left the room was, why should he? You know? An attitude like that, like I'm going to do it unless you stop me, that's not the attitude of the devotee who asks humbly, you know, what should I do, Lord? Now, the other side of it, there's a story in my book about this where a woman wrote to Swami and said, I'm praying and praying to Master for guidance in this very important decision, and I just can't feel what he wants. And Swami wrote back, he said, it doesn't matter, make either choice. And it was a really important, you know, seeming life direction choice. He said, Master doesn't care which one you do. He's pleased only that you're trying to live in harmony with him. And on another occasion when a woman was going to she said to Swami, "Sir, you know, you've given me advice I can't follow." And his instantaneous response, without missing a beat, was, "Well, so much for theory, let's work with reality," just like that. And so he then counseled her to go ahead and do the very thing that he'd suggested she not do, because her desire to do so was too strong. And then, you know, on the eve of following through on that, she said to him, "Sir, you know, is this a good thing or a bad thing I'm about to do?" He said, "It's nothing." He said, "It's just an action. It's a neutral action. Whether it turns out good or bad for you spiritually depends on whether you do it humbly with devotion or whether you allow this experience to go to your ego." You know, so we have this such a fixed idea that this is what Master wants, this is what Master doesn't want. Part of it, this is also, I don't think I actually wrote this in the book, but this woman came to him once with this intense question about, she was in this really horrible relationship with this terribly unsuitable man, but she had this superstitious concern that maybe he was really the destined one for her, and she was blowing it, and if she broke up with him, then she would have missed her chance. I mean, you know, you just, once you leave common sense at the door, you have a whole lot of trouble figuring anything out. So she went through this whole thing with, I'll come back to that in a minute, but this woman, and so Swami was supportive of her and basically tried to assert common sense, you know. He's not really on the path. He's abusive. You don't like him. Maybe those are signs that you shouldn't be with him. No, these are clues, breadcrumbs on the path, so to speak. After he left, she left, Swami said to me, though. He said, "She has so many lessons to learn. Honestly, she could learn them with just about anyone." You know, he said, it's a long, long time on your path before your karma is so specific that it really matters. Most of the time, you're just working with such, you know, you have so many different karmic lessons to learn that it's not a question of circumstances, it's a question of inner attitude. You understand the difference? And so we're always trying to make it that God wants this and doesn't want that. He did want this and he opened that door. Master writes very confusingly about this in Whispers from Eternity, less confusingly since Swami edited the book, actually. But still, Master says people don't know whether their prayers were actually answered or whether it was just the karma that played itself out or whether the result was the result of other forces. He just leaves you. You know, people are saying, "Well, I prayed for it and it happened, therefore God wants it." But Master just throws all this doubt into the issue. You don't really know whether it was the result of prayer or not because many other factors can play just the flow of your karma. And then what he's really going on to say and what he says in that book, Whispers from Eternity, by reading the prayers, you can see it, which is these are the things for which it is appropriate to pray because these are the things for which God has answers. And always, it's how can I love you more? How can I serve you more? How can I be more open-hearted? How can I be more kind? How can I be more even-minded? How can I have courage? How can I fight the battle when I don't want to fight anymore? How do I overcome disappointment and discouragement? How do I rise above the negative forces that are around me? Those are the prayers. There's no prayer in that whole book that says, should I marry John or should I marry Edward? Should I take the job in Seattle or should I do the one in St. Louis? You know, should I buy the pink house or should I paint the room blue? You know, maybe you feel a sort of intuitive flow about some of these things, but God isn't concerned on that level. Those are just the little tiny ups and downs of the ocean. What he wants to know is how deeply we are willing to give up everything in earnest self-offering and utter childlike trust. You know? That's why, and forgive me, I don't want to beat a dead horse here. That's why I always come back to tithing. I love tithing. Because it is one of those issues where you really, that's something that really matters. And it's not because of the money. People think I'm saying this because Ananda needs money. You know, I beg you, if that's what you think, tithe somewhere else. But what I'm saying is, are we really willing to trust God when it's not easy to trust him? Or is our trust in God when he makes things work for us? You know, putting really fighting the battle with the part of us that is really the enemy, which isn't whether we have prosperity or not, it's the part of ourselves that thinks the ego is in charge. And that I'm only with God if it's convenient for me, and then at the rest of the time I'm not. And this is where also Swami's talking in this chapter. There's this conscious force. We have to realize that we don't just remain neutral. I love this part where he says it here. Let me think. Where he talks about how God gets angry with us because we sin, when in fact God makes sin so attractive. You know, why would he do that? And, you know, he was talking about how some gods, sometimes people think that, here he is, and yes, some people, this is right after the chapter where he talks about Bob will get the diploma for which his parents have been praying so earnestly. Some people in the past have viewed God alternatively as a god of wrath and jealousy, again, very personal in his concern for the human scene, but angry enough with sinners to condemn them to eternal hell, even though, Swami says, this has to be said. He gives people all the incentive they need to sin and to sin exuberantly. You know, these incentives are often overwhelming and cannot be blamed on man alone. Isn't that interesting the way he puts that? You know, he's just sort of showing us that if we keep trying to define God in terms of all these human experiences, that he wants this and doesn't want that, we just miss the point. It's a much deeper reality that we're working with. And this is where he also says earlier, you know, that victory is not absolute. There is no final objective victory for either good or evil. That's, you know, the Armageddon theories that the whole world is going to be wiped out and then the saved will be saved and the damned will be damned, which is really a brutal teaching. I remember a man was telling me actually that he was raised in such a strict fundamentalist concept that the day of rapture was going to come. He said every time when he came home from school, he was frightened that he would get there and his whole family would be gone because it would have been the day of rapture and they all would have been taken and that he would have been left. And he lived with this terrible anxiety every day when he left his parents' company until he saw them again for fear. I mean, because that was, you know, such a barbaric teaching. Savitri, who's at Ananda Village now, Savitri, she grew up also, her mother was very, very fundamentalist in her belief. And part of the belief was that if Savitri, her only daughter, who was called Jane at the time, did not accept Jesus Christ, then if something happened and she died, even as a child, she'd be damned to hell and that her mother would never see her again, because her mother, of course, was going to heaven because she's accepted Jesus Christ. So she was constantly anxious that her little daughter, Jane, accept Jesus Christ. And finally, Jane had no real interest in doing it, but at the age of 10, she decided she would accept Jesus Christ. So she went through the whole ceremony in the church, and she's kneeling at the altar. This is Memphis, Tennessee. And Savitri now tells the story in her little accent. She said she knelt there at the altar and silently looked up at Jesus and said, "I have no quarrel with you, Jesus, but I want you to understand I'm only doing this to get my mama off my back." You know, she was going to be straight with him if she wasn't going to be straight with her mother. And I think a lot of people do that, you know. You just get so scared. Now, admittedly, for some people, if they weren't frightened into being good, they would be really bad. And so being frightened into being good is a beginning, because then you get a taste of what it is to be good, and you're saved from the worst of your temptations, and nothing less than that will get you out of really actions that aren't going to make you happy either. So it's a stage, you know. Yes, Patrick.
Isn't it really just a suppression which sometimes just
blows
builds up
later?
And blows up?
Well, it can at first be a suppression, but here's what happens is if a person is living a really dissolute life, let's say they're promiscuous, they maybe have a drug problem, they're irresponsible in their relationships, then they suddenly get religion and want Jesus to love them and fear they're going to go to hell if they don't change, and they become so concerned about hell that that fear causes them to exercise discipline, they may discover in the exercise of that discipline that life is really a lot more harmonious if I don't do those things. And so that may force them into having an experience, and the experience is what will teach them. This is when we're progressing through the four castes. The lowest caste is the only thing that motivates you to put out energy to do the right thing is fear of punishment. But when you are threatened, you may behave properly, and in the right action, you will discover a greater pleasure than you had in the wrong action. And you might start by fear of punishment, but later you will discover that it's an end in itself. In the same way, the next level, you act only for reward, but in acting creatively for what you can get yourself, you may gradually discover that it feels better to be creative than it does just to sit here like a lump. And then you're no longer thinking quite so much about the rewards, you're just thinking about the pleasure of putting out energy. So if you're, it's okay to be motivated for the wrong reasons into the right action, because potentially that will teach you. And so it's not wrong. I know Swami Kriyananda taught one of our mothers a very good lesson, because her son was very vaishya in his way of thinking, which meant he would do things only if there was something in it for him. And the mother knew this about the child, but always hesitated to play to that. And Swami, I've told you this, wanted to take a family portrait of this. It was a very attractive family. This was the youngest child, and the youngest child just crawled under the bed and wouldn't come out. And Swami really wanted to take the whole family portrait for some slideshow he was doing. And Swami just got down on the floor and said, "Daniel, I have chocolate from Switzerland. I'll give you a whole bar if you'll come out and let me take your picture." Daniel comes scooting out from under bed, you know, and is right there. And from then on, the mother bribed the child. And she just paid him to do the right thing. And gradually, he discovered that she had to pay him less and less. It worked. You know, otherwise, she wasn't going to beat him. And there was no fear of punishment to institute, because she wasn't really going to punish him that way. He wasn't motivated by high ideals, but he was motivated by personal reward. So she got him moving through personal reward. And then he began to see that it was more fun to cooperate. Fortunately, he wasn't a really gross child. But if Swami hadn't offered him the chocolate, she would never have had the nerve to just go with what moved him. So that's why God makes these fear-inducing religions, because it helps people who need that to be motivated. And they also need it to be absolutely cut and dried. There can't be any subtleties. It's either damnation or it's salvation. So even though when your mind gets more subtle, these things seem barbaric, at a certain stage, they're just exactly what people need. But, you know, that's not where we're standing, and that's not what the Bhagavad Gita is about. What do you think, Patrick?
It seems wrong to approach someone, if you see that they're that way, to give up on them as no hope of further advancement through teachings that they could learn.
Oh, no, it's just the opposite. You're doing them a great service by perceiving what will actually motivate them. You see, if you perceive that a person will only be motivated by fear of punishment, and you continually try to inspire him by appearing to an idealism that he doesn't comprehend at all, you're actually condemning him to no progress. He'll never put out energy on the basis of idealism. He'll think you're an idiot. But if you can get him to put out energy on the basis of what interests him, then he will put out energy, and energy has its own intelligence. And once he starts putting out energy, he'll learn something. So you're actually helping him.
But Ananda, someone from Ananda, could never approach a fundamentalist Christian and threaten them.
No, but you just, we're not, I would never talk to a fundamentalist Christian about these teachings.
Well, that was what I was saying. So it seems wrong to capitulate, to give up on these people.
No, you're not giving up on them, but you don't, you have to treat people appropriately. And the expansion of consciousness is gradual and progressive. This is a very, very important point. You know, if we believe in reincarnation, if we believe in the gradual unfoldment of awareness, it follows that people are at different stages of awareness. You know, some people are more advanced and some people are behind you. And people are moving appropriately forward, and you have to help them in ways that will actually reach them and not just ways that please you.
It seems that sometimes people might make huge leaps forward.
Might make huge leaps?
That's happened. I've certainly heard their stories.
Well, huge leaps, I'm not quite sure what we're talking about then.
The villain, the robber, who somehow got a contact with a yogi and realized he was wrong and shortly became enlightened.
Yes, but he was... Yes, people can make sudden leaps, but then they come into the contact with a person who can help them, and that person has the intuition to know what to say. fair enough. I mean, if I was with someone, if Swami's with someone and feels the intuition that they can help him, he would say whatever he feels to say. I mean, Swami was approached by a beggar, and Swami reprimanded him for not getting a job and gave him $1 and said he would never give him any more because he ought to be working. You know, it's just like that's... when Swami met Reverend Wormbrand, who was a great Christian man with a fairly narrow philosophy, but a saintly man nonetheless, Swami didn't try to teach him anything about our path. He just, you know, was thrilled to be in the man's company. He never said a word about anything he could have said. It wasn't appropriate. When he's met with devout Christians, he just leaves them where they are. It's not appropriate to tell them something else. When he was approached by a fanatical Christian in the Holy Land, in Israel, this is in my book too, and the man says, "Are you saved? Or do you believe that Jesus died for your sins on the cross?" And Swami said, "How could God die?" And then he just left it, and then he just walked off. He didn't try to preach anything more because it wouldn't have been appropriate. Fair enough? Yeah. But if somebody comes up to you and it's perfectly appropriate and you know they're ready, such as the great robber that I know the story you're talking about, he met the saint saw that he was ready, and he gave it to him, and he was able to receive it. But it's a great mistake that people of more refined consciousness make, that they try to argue with people on the terms that make sense to them. Who are we serving? Who are we serving by just presenting our most convincing arguments that are completely useless to them? And a lot of idealistic people do that. Why do you make the DDT? You shouldn't make the DDT. And the man who's only interested in self-interest said, if I didn't make it, somebody else would. You know, there's a dollar to be made. You know, what's it to you, honey? Because we have this idealistic idea about the whole planet. He's not motivated. He doesn't even understand those ideals. He thinks that he's making a good living for his family. You know? And you preach to a brave soldier that pacifism is a better way of life, and he just feels demeaned by you. He doesn't feel uplifted or inspired. You know, you have to reach people where they're really going to move. Fair enough?
You don't talk to the Jehovah Witnesses?
No, I don't. Because it's also not fair to them. No, I know you're half joking, but it's not fair. Because if I sow doubt in their minds, they might go far backwards. They need to be Jehovah's Witnesses, or else they might be on the street doing far worse. You know, many of those people are fighting a constant battle against the temptation to fall really far back. And so if they've managed to claw their way up to a fanatical religion, then I say hallelujah for them. I would prefer they not invade my space, but it's easy enough to do. What difference does it make? Who cares what people say to you? You know. When we dedicated the temple in... Ananda dedicated this new temple in Seattle. Some man came, this beautiful new temple, this huge event. Some man came with his picket sign. He stood at the end of the driveway and shouted at all of us that we were going to hell. And I don't know what his sign said. It said something or another about hell. And he was just enraged. And various people went down there. We took him lunch, you know. Just tried to be nice to him. And he tried not to be nice to us. But, you know, didn't matter to us. It was just his reality. He was really felt he was doing God's work by witnessing against us. In fact, when we were in Los Angeles, involved with the SRF convocation, when we were actually picketing the SRF convocation at that time, and that we had this room where we had all our things set up. And the first night we were there, we were wondering, is anybody going to come and see us? And this whole crowd of people came, about five or six people came in, but they didn't come in. They knelt at the door and prayed for us. Turned out later they were just, you know, a group of people witnessing, trying to save our souls. It was such an irony. We were there trying to stand up for our rights against this other group of disciples, and then this whole third group comes in and kneels and prays for us. It was just, it was comic, really. It had reached comic proportions by that point. Well, I think this is a good point to take a break. Let's do that. Yes, of course you can, Danny. Let's wait till we get the system running. Okay, Danny, you have a question?
What is meant by sentiment?
I'm sorry?
What is meant by sentiment?
Oh, when I speak of, he says, foolish sentiment, sweet, foolish sentiment, and I speak of sentimentality. A sentiment is just sort of a cherished belief that isn't necessarily based on actual empirical evidence. And so it's a pleasant sentiment to think that, and it's not necessarily a harmful one to think that Master got this car for me. It's a pleasant sentiment because why not? Take him with you, buy your car, have that real experience. There's a fine line here, and it's a little bit like what Patrick was saying. If people do the right thing even for the wrong reason, they may discover in doing the right thing the right reason for doing the right thing, because experience will teach them. If we're just trying to begin our relationship with the Guru and we want to have this sense of always being remembering that Master is with us, we start with something that's more like a pleasant sentiment, that he's with us, that he's enjoying our lunch with us. And at the beginning, it may just be a sentimental idea, which is that it's just our feeling about it, and it doesn't really represent a superconscious connection. But it begins us to be thinking in the right way, and it begins to orient us in that right way. And then gradually, as we do it, and as we simultaneously get deeper and deeper, that which starts out as a pleasant sentiment actually gradually becomes a real deep intuition. And that, so it's sort of like I can't speak entirely against it, but sometimes what happens is we get so attached to our sentiments that when common sense evidence comes in against it, we cling to our sentiment instead. And that's where it becomes a danger. And that's why Swami says, sweet, and he used the word sweet sentiments. The second adjective, of course, is foolish. But the first one is sweet, so let's take out foolish. Sweet sentiments don't win him. And he's really just trying to say, it's not that they're wrong, it's just that more is required. Earnest, complete self-offering does. And so you can see the difference is how impersonal we are about our desires, how much magnetism we're putting behind our desires, whether we're just drifting with the current and calling it spiritual, or whether we're really on a day-to-day, moment-to-moment basis willing to really do battle and ask the real questions. Am I really acting in a way of complete self-offering to God, or am I just asking God to come in and support my little world? And it's very hard questions. That's why I was saying myself, I have learned to be very careful about my intuitions. I mean, I have to also be honest enough to say that I've had a lot of experience of both true and false intuition. So I have learned from really bad experience to be a little more conscious of the difference. And so there are times when I do have a strong inner feeling that I do trust, but I have a lot of other feelings that may or may not be true. I mean, I know once when I just did something really stupid and just dragged a whole lot of people down with me, Swamiji afterwards just said, yes, he said, when your ego gets involved, you make really stupid decisions, you know? And it was just one of those where, when I looked back on it, I could see how this great force of energy that I had read as intuition was really nothing but my own self-motivation just moving me. And I'd never stood back with enough impartiality to actually see the situation. But you know, big, bad experiences like that teach you. And then gradually you can tell. But that's that really earnest self-offering where we're willing really to be wrong. I remember in another circumstance, I had a true intuition, and it proved to be a true intuition, and it felt true to me, but then I got very egoically involved in asserting that over others and then created this huge fight with all these different people. It was one of those memorable cycles where just, you know, I just was stirring up all this energy and people were opposing me with all this. It just, the whole thing became awful. And at one point I just realized, and I wrote a letter out to everyone that said, I felt that my intuition was true, but whether true or false, by now I have so obscured it with my own egoic preferences that I'm going to abandon my position and just leave it to others to decide. When I pulled out completely and let the dust settle and let the thing roll on, they all decided to do exactly what I had proposed in the first place. which was a very interesting cycle for me because I saw both sides of it. I saw that I had been right, but that I corrupted it with my egoic involvement. And when I was willing to humble myself and just stand back, then the truth of what I had said was able to come up again. But these are long cycles, and we're often wrong. But the way Swami put it to me, but people have to try to follow their intuition because it's important to learn. And so, but I'm just saying here that we have to be very careful that we don't get ourselves ruled merely by sentiment, but just say, okay, that's how I feel about it. It's a lovely thought, isn't it? Let's see how it unfolds. Let's see what else happens. Let's see what other people think. Is that fair enough? Because it is, it's not that easy. It's just not that easy to just know what God wants on one hand. It's not that easy to just have Master walk with us and guide every single little thing that we do. It's a much higher superconscious state than just our decision that we're going to do that. You know, real attunement is a very, very dynamic state. And we don't want to sell ourselves short. You see how complex all this is? We don't want to sell ourselves short by claiming that Master guides me in everything, when the truth of the matter is we've hardly begun. And yet at the same time, we want to always feel that Master guides me in everything. So you see the fine line that you have to walk? I know I'm not hardly making sense, but it's a very fine line. We don't want to claim victories we haven't earned, and yet we want to affirm the possibility of those victories being ours by earnest self-offering at all times and by getting the book Whispers from Eternity and finding out how we should really pray, what we should really pray for. And by constantly bringing our attunement back to the prayer for right consciousness. You know, Master, help me in this new car that you seem to have given me to have the right relationship to it. Help me to be free at all times. Thank you for helping me. Thank you for being with me. Thank you for causing me to fail. Thank you for helping me to succeed. Thank you for making me comfortable. Thank you for making me miserable. You know, it has to be a constant. If we're going to thank him for all the little things he gives us, we have to have exactly the same sense of appreciation and God giving it to us when it goes completely gablooey. Otherwise, it's just merely a sweet sentiment. You see? Does that make sense? Yeah, and it's really actually quite fun because it's so dynamic then, and there's never a moment when we can't practice. You know? We can always be in actually a very dynamic relationship. Okay, any other questions or thoughts on all of that? Yes, Lisa?
This idea of decision-making, it's very complicated because it's not a decision to do A or B or C. There's a decision that to follow the master is more the decision when you have something in front of you, and then almost just be glad if there is a failure or an obstacle, because the decision is how you will learn. So it's not a matter of making the right decision sometimes, because it's the wrong decision, it seems, that's going to be the most beneficial.
Well, it not necessarily. Both are beneficial. Having things come out correctly and then knowing what it felt like on the way that you could see that it all unfolded. And correct means that consciousness is lifted. Your own consciousness, the consciousness of others, something beautiful is created. You know, it's all about inner consciousness. Picking up a leaf with devotion. And it says, you know, even a leaf, if offered with devotion, St. John of the Cross said, you know, one act of just sweeping a garden, if it's done with pure love of God, can do more good for the world than all the great, you know, than all the great charity hospitals that are built that are just wet waves rising and falling. What really moves this world and moves us is our consciousness. And sometimes adversity builds character, but sometimes success also builds character, because then one has an understanding of how to be in the flow. And in fact, Master says something, Swami said it, which was very almost shocking to me. He said, failure is the result always of a lack of attunement. And if we're more attuned, you know, success is the result of attunement. Success meaning you move in harmony. It's a bit of a funny statement, but I had to really stop and rethink that, because I would say sometimes, well, sometimes we need to fail, but we need to fail in order to find out what attunement is. But what is failure? Failure is not necessarily that it works out in a human sense, but that it works out in a divine sense. Jesus was a total failure. You know, he was crucified. But as Swami described, sometimes God has to reduce everything to a zero humanly so that it can be built up again in a divine way. And so sometimes we do have to be reduced to zero so that we can be built up again in a divine way. But then we are built up. We become an instrument. Swami describes it in here. He said, even though God doesn't have favorites, the fact is if you cooperate with God, it works better for you. Because the whole universe then, I love the way he put it, the whole universe then becomes a sounding board, like a guitar, like the string on a guitar. So our consciousness becomes attuned to the universal flow, and therefore everything we do is magnified, all the good that we can do is magnified by the sounding board of our cooperation with the divine force. So you see a person like Swami Kriyananda, or like Master himself, or St. Teresa of Avila, or St. Francis, and you see all that they have done is magnified by the great sounding board of the infinite behind them. And then they're able to be a tremendous force for the only thing that matters, which is inspiring others to also uplift their own consciousness, to individually take the plunge into the depth of the ocean. But individuals who are not cooperating with that, well, they aren't able, they may be able to do something in a small sphere, but they aren't able to uplift in the same way. Maybe they uplift a few, do a little bit of good work, but the more attuned we get with that power, the more powerful we can be. So therefore, it's essential that we practice and then fail. But I guess what I'm saying, the best way to practice is with real humility and understanding that we shouldn't settle. See, what happens is we climb this little hillock, and now we have an apartment, and now we really think that we're in tune with Master. It's not that there was nothing here, but we've got the Himalayas behind us. You know, sweet sentiment, even though it's very pleasing to us. And, you know, I like to think about it too. You know, I went shopping and Master helped me find a lovely pair of shoes. Please, sir, I'd like some new sandals. Oh, look, there they are. What store should I go into? Yes, that's right, they were right there. But it's a pleasing sentiment. I don't mistake it for real God realization. But then sometimes I remember very vividly when I was very early on the spiritual path, Swami Kriyananda he would go in seclusion sometimes then, and he would often be in silence sometimes because he was writing, must have been when he was writing the path, he would often go into silence. And I was sitting in his living room, and he wasn't speaking, and he didn't have, now he has someone cook for him all these things, then it was all so much simpler. He was fixing himself lunch, and I watched him make a chapati with his hands. He made a chapati, then he cooked the chapati, all this in silence. And he was, you know, the house was small, and he was about where the harmonium was. I was sitting in the lower part of the dome, and he was up in the kitchen. And I just watched him make this chapati, put it on the stove. And all I can say is I could feel that he was in Master's company doing it. And I sort of watched him do that, and I asked myself, what could make such a simple action feel so profound? And it felt so profound to me because it wasn't just a sentiment with him. He'd passed beyond the sentiment to the point of real attunement. So that he was, when he was thinking of making lunch with Master, his vibration was really on Master's level, and I could just feel this was there was a divine experience happening while he made this little lunch. And you know, I can feel that Master's helping me cook, but I'm honest enough to be able to tell the difference between it being a pleasing sentiment to me and a very appropriate one, and a real superconscious experience. And that's really what I'm trying to emphasize. I think that's the end of what I'm really trying to say with all of this. Don't settle for less. Don't fool yourself into settling for less. You know, recognize that, yes, this is a good direction, but don't stop there. You know, really read deeply about the battle of Kurukshetra and really read what it says, you know, perceives that all actions are performed, you know, not by me alone, but by the self. You know, what am I really experiencing? Am I really so far beyond my own ego that I'm just feeling the power of spirit moving through me? If I'm not, then I say honestly and quietly, well, I have a ways to go. You know? And in the meantime, look at this lovely car that Master got me. You know, but I know this isn't the end of my spiritual path. And look how nicely Master got me fired. Look how falsely he accused me. Look at how all those people lied. Look at how broke I am, and now I've lost my home. Master took my home away from me. If he's going to give it to you, he's going to take it away from you. If he's the acting force in your life, he's going to do whatever's good for you. And that, of course, is the practice. We have to practice when it's easier so that when the going gets tough, the habit is there. And that's the detachment. We enjoy it, but we have neither defined God's love for us nor our own happiness by this all working out. Then the Master has that, Swami has that wonderful story about Master and the shortbread. That Master, the shortbread was always there in that little store, so Master stopped to get it, and then it wasn't there. And Master just said, Divine Mother, why not? You know, it's always been there. And then a shaft of light seems to touch the shop, and the woman runs out with shortbread for him. He didn't care about the shortbread, but he only moved from the inspiration of Divine Mother, and he didn't understand why he would feel inclined to go buy it if it wasn't going to be there for him. But what he was really talking about is that level of attunement within himself. There's a beautiful story about Mother Teresa of Calcutta, when she was caring for some maggot-infested, dying beggar on the street, holding him in her arms, and someone basically said, how can you stand it? And she said, I see only the face of Jesus. And that was very simple. She didn't see a maggot-infested beggar. She saw the face of Jesus. Probably when she started, she had to affirm that. But by constantly bringing her attention, however she did it, to the point between the eyebrows, to the heart, to the picture of Jesus, you know, asking him to work through her, gradually it moved from affirmation to actual perception by the exercise of earnest self-offering. And in her case, utter childlike trust. You know, she put everything on the line. And then gradually that willingness made the experience not merely a sentiment or an affirmation, but an actual reality. And you know, our teachings are so rich. We have Kriya, we have so many different ways of turning that into an actual experience. It's not just a dogma that we have to hope for. We have many, many ways in which we can actually transform our chakras so that what starts out as a pleasing sentiment in the end becomes a true experience. There's a story about in the life of Sri Ramakrishna of this woman who was called Golap Ma, they call Gopala Ma. And she was a devotee of the baby Krishna. And she was a Brahmin widow, and for decades she just did this ritualistic worship of this little statue of the baby Krishna, and she just had this whole thing that she did. And then just he came alive for her. And all of a sudden she was in the company of this mischievous little child. And the story is so beautifully told. Here she's this ritualistic woman. She's been doing this all this time. And all of a sudden, instead of having a little statue, she has an actual mischievous two-year-old boy who's knocking the things off her altar and preventing her from doing her worship. And she runs to Ramakrishna. And, you know, and the little baby comes with her. And for like several weeks, she was just in this ecstatic state, in which after all these years of just ritualistic worship, all of a sudden, the baby Gopal is really with her. And she's a widowed woman who never had any children. She's mothering this baby. It's just an incredible story. And it just really happened for her. Her guru, who was Ramakrishna, you know, this is how you want to see God. Okay, I'll give him to you. And then, you know, then after a time, it passed away. But of course, she was never the same after that. And it didn't start that way. It started waving incense in front of a little statue. Very moving. Yeah. Okay, any other questions or thoughts? Okay, I think that'll do us for tonight.